I'm Shiva, the god of death.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Next Lander Watchcast. It is December. We have successfully made it through the month of November and our marathon Star Trek watching of the month. I hope you all enjoyed that. But we are now back to our alternating schedule here on the Watchcast. We got a couple of movies lined up for you here in the month of December. And we're going to have a couple of episodes of Star Trek, one podcast of Star Trek, but a couple of episodes that I think are actually some pretty key ones in the overall lineage. Before we get to that, we've got a movie today, and this is one that is both of the movies this month, I'm going to say, are films that were high on Brad Shoemaker's list to watch, and this one was a recent addition. Brad, why don't you set us up here and tell us why you wanted to watch 2007's Michael Clayton?
Because I am turning this podcast into a vehicle for my own self-indulgence.
I thought we already kind of started from that point, but that's fine.
Yep. Hey, man, I'm happy to keep. Look, when it comes to movies I have not seen, the list is endless.
Yes.
Happy to provide guidance and material here.
But there was a particular reason for this
one. Yeah. Because Andor is probably one of the best TV shows I have ever seen at this point. And coming off of that, I was like, I just need more Tony Gilroy. I anticipate, like, two episodes from the end, I was like, I anticipate a void in my life when this show is over. And what better way to fill that void than with more of the man who made this?
Than with a movie about a guy who is basically a walking void.
Yeah, fair. Okay, sure.
For most of it, you know.
But his filmography is not extensive, it turns out, unless we want to include all of his, like, script doctoring, which I guess is a whole different conversation, but...
Yes.
As far as the directed by Tony Gilroy, it's like three movies, right?
It's like three or four total, and this was his first.
Hmm. Oh,
yes.
Really?
This was the first movie he had directed. Before we get into that, though, Vinny Caravella, you had also not seen Michael Clayton.
No.
Am I correct?
I had no idea what this movie was. My wife didn't really know what this movie was. We thought maybe, when we talked about it at the dinner table, she said, is that the movie... Oh, Michael Clayton, that's the one about Sinn Féin, right? And in Ireland. I was like, oh, maybe. Yeah, okay, that sounds about
that's
right.
That's Michael Collins.
We were.
You're so close. Like, it is a C last name, same first name, but it is not that.
There's nothing better than having zero idea what you're getting into and then really enjoying a movie. Like, it's
so you didn't even know the reputation of this movie at all, really?
No.
Okay.
Not. And I had known because we had talked about it, about the connection with Tony Gilroy and whatchamacallit? Andor, sorry. And boy, they're thematically so far.
You got a guy who
really hates big old corporations stomping on people.
Versus a guy who basically goes to bat for those horrible corporations stomping
uh-huh.
on people.
Yes.
Until the end.
Yeah, I think there's, I mean, we'll get more into Michael Clayton, but I would say between Andor and Michael Clayton, you have a bit of morally gray protagonist in both. So
yes.
I think thematically, you know, a lot of janitors, let's say,
yes.
in the Gilroy universe.
There's a lot of janitors in the Gilroy universe and a lot of janitors in the Star Wars universe. And
uh-huh.
in Andor, it sounds like you actually get to meet the janitors, which is pretty cool. I have not seen Andor yet. That is going to be my holiday
okay.
viewing at the end of the month, so I'm looking really forward to that. And going back to this movie, which I will say straight up is one of my favorite movies of the aughts, period. If there was a top 10 of 2000 to 2009, this movie would be on there for me.
Dude, this is not central to discussion of this film,
mm-hmm.
but I spent the entire movie trying to peg not even the release year, but like maybe even the release decade. Like I...
Mm.
kept swinging, with the exception of the one iPod that makes a brief appearance.
Yes.
Which I forgot about. I was, the whole time, I was like, this could be 1995 or 2005.
A lot of
I'm really not sure.
Like, the kid's monitor is maybe a little too nice for 1995, but nonetheless,
yeah. But
yeah.
I don't think, it's still all CRTs in this thing. This movie is all CRTs and VHS and cassette tapes, except for that one iPod.
We are in that extremely narrow window where... phones that could receive email and take pictures existed, but before smartphones took
yeah.
over.
Yeah. We're like after the, was it the SmartTAC, the kind of that big old Motorola flip thing, StarTAC,
I think.
And they were between that and like the Verizon flip phone with the bad LED screen or LCD screen.
Before we get into kind of some background on the film and getting really into the plot here, here's the setup for Michael Clayton. George Clooney plays the titular character, and his job is a fixer for a major New York law firm that takes on all manner of corporate and rich clients, of varying degrees of scumbaggery. And his job primarily is to deal with the things that no reputable lawyer will want to do, whether that is, you know, getting people out of drunk driving tickets, hit and runs, making sure that, you know, people who want to get through the immigration process can, you know, be expedited. He knows the right people to bribe. He knows the right people to talk to. And he is basically the sort of black ops operative for this law firm.
Is it like the white glove service you kind of get by giving billions or millions to this law firm to represent you? You kind of get a Michael Clayton in case you run afoul or a family member runs afoul of the law?
He's the lawyer behind glass that you break in case of emergency that cannot be easily smoothed over.
Okay.
There's a great scene right up front, which, like, you can tell instantly that's not going to be the crux of the movie, but where he goes to help out the dude who, basically a rich asshole who committed a hit and run and wants to get out of it. And he's like, fucking, there's no getting out of this. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Guy's like, fucking just the most spoiled rich asshole, like pitching a fit about like, I don't pay a retainer every month just to be put in the back of the line.
Right. Yeah.
Like that's, it's just set up. Like, it has nothing to do with the main plot, but that's not to like try to Andor pill this entire episode.
No, by all means.
Like, it's like efficiency of storytelling is one of the things that is so impressive about that show. And like, you see that in 10 minutes here as well of like, you get exactly what Michael Clayton is about and how good he is at it in that one like 5 minute scene.
Mm-hmm. Even as this guy who is fantastically played by Dennis O'Hare here, just completely tears him down because he can't just make it wash away. You know, like he's telling him this guy had a hit and run. It was like late at night, hit a jogger on the road with his Jaguar. And he's freaking out because, you know, it's a hit and run. And Michael Clayton is telling him, we have lawyers up here. We have people we like for this. We can help you, but I can't make this go away because you nearly killed someone.
And flip.
And the guy is just losing his mind. He's like, you know, I was told you were a miracle worker. And he's like, I'm not a miracle worker. I'm a janitor.
I love that line.
And
it's
nothing sets up
have,
the rest of this movie better than that particular line.
I've been a client at Kenner Bock for 12 years. Do you think that I pay that retainer every month so I can give a place at the back of the line?
Mr. Greer, you left the scene of an accident on a slow weeknight, 6 miles from the state police barracks. Believe me, if there's a line, you're right up front.
I can get a lawyer anytime I want to. I don't need you for that. We're not sitting here for 45 minutes waiting for a goddamn referral.
I don't know what Walter promised you, but I can tell
you. A miracle worker. That's Walter on the phone 20 minutes ago. Direct quote, okay? Hang tight. I'm sending you a miracle worker.
Oh, he misspoke.
About what? About the fact that you're the firm's fixer? Or that you're any good at it?
Elliot.
The guy was running in the street! You take that! You add the fog, you add the lamps, you add the angle. What the fuck is he doing running in the middle of the street at midnight, huh? You answer me that!
What if someone has stolen the car? Huh? Happens all the time.
Cops like hit and runs. They work them hard, they clear them fast. Right now there's a BCI unit pulling paint chips off a guardrail. Tomorrow they're going to be looking for the owner of a custom-painted, hand-rubbed Jaguar XJ12. And the guy you hit? If you got to look at the plates, it won't even take that long. There's no play here. There's no angle, there's no champagne room. I'm not a miracle worker, I'm a janitor. The math on this is simple. The smaller the mess, the easier it is for me to clean up.
That's the police, isn't it?
No. They don't call.
Yeah, very good.
I also want to give a quick shout out in the wordless dialogue here from the wife, who literally just throws a glass and looks pissed off. Julie White, who I mostly know as a judge on Iron Chef America, is the wife here.
Interesting. Yeah, like that's. I mean, even before she throws the glass, you can tell she's extremely sick of her husband's shit.
Yeah. Like, she appreciates the wealth that probably he brings along, but, like, also, this guy is a real piece of shit.
Not a happy household.
No. But this is not the crux of the movie. The crux of the movie is, involves Tom Wilkinson's Arthur, who is sort of the attack dog lawyer of this firm, who has spent the last 6 years working on a class action suit for UNorth, a Monsanto-like... I would
say, let's say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, I love that eventually you find out their actual name is United Northfield, which sounds way more dystopian, but they have rebranded with the cutesy little plant growing out of the ground logo to UNorth.
They have friendlified their name in such a way. But a class action lawsuit has been filed on behalf of a number of people in Wisconsin who had used a weed killer that they produced that resulted in cancer for a number of farmers and their families. So it is a multi-billion dollar lawsuit.
At that point, allegedly, right? The
yes, allegedly. Sprinkling allegedly in there.
Right.
And Wilkinson's Arthur is the lead lawyer on this, but he is also a manic depressive. And in the midst of all of this, has gone off his medication and had what one might refer to as an epiphany that is also tinged with a degree of mental illness and, you know, in a loss of control that results in him stripping naked during a deposition and pleading to one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit to forgive him for his sins.
We came back from the hospital and everybody was crying and we were in shock, but we still weed milk.
The cows won't wait, will they?
No.
And when you went to the barn?
We found the note. My sister found it.
From your mother?
Yes.
Could you read it for us, please? Just read the third paragraph, just the highlighted section there.
I don't want you blaming Ned Hardy or any other people.
Anna, go on.
I'm just...
excuse me.
Anna,
what's he doing?
He loves her. I love her. I love you so much. Forgive me. Forgive me. On camera, we should say, in a video recorded deposition. Was it only 6 years? I thought it was longer. Is it 6 years?
He said he had been working on the case for 6 years.
Okay. Yeah, he basically has, for all intents and purposes, a breakdown and a crisis of conscience.
And Clayton, alongside Tilda Swinton's Karen, the main the main lawyer for UNorth internally, are both sent to Wisconsin to try and clean up this mess. And where it goes from there is a crisis of conscience for a number of characters that results in some remarkably poor decision-making and also some, you know, some moments of clarity for everyone involved. Maybe not so much Karen, but...
Yeah.
And that is the basic plot.
I feel like we need to mention the nonlinear storytelling in this because it actually starts practically at the end with George Clooney almost being blown up in his car. It essentially is an act of God that he just happened to, while he was up in Westchester, helping hit and run asshole on his way out of town. He just like sees some horses in a field and decides to stop and go wander up and pet the horses.
And it's very surreal.
While he's like dreamily sort of standing and regarding the horses, his car explodes.
Yes.
And you don't know
much of anything that's going on at this point in the movie.
You know he's a gambler at this point because he has spent a little bit of time in the card room But other than that, yeah, you have no real sense of who this character is other than the fact that he is a bag man.
Yeah.
It's one of my notes about this movie. One of my few notes. I really like that. But one of my notes is that everybody else in this movie is better at subtext than I am. Like, there is a lot of stuff that goes unspoken throughout a lot of the movie that I think intentionally you're not supposed to fully grasp or put together until way later on. But for a lot of the movie, you're kind of left with this suspended cord, right? Waiting for resolution. Like, what is happening? There's a lot of, not intricate, but there's a tree of relationships that you have to put together throughout the movie that is fully explained by the end. But for most of the movie, you really don't understand that final scene until the very end of the movie.
Yeah. And like you said, some of those relationships are really just established by the way characters talk to one another. Like, you don't really know who Marty is until people start referencing him. And then as soon as him and Clayton get in the same room, you get the understanding that not only is he his boss, he's almost like this kind of father-like figure to him and some of the other main characters in this law firm. And
it's really, the movie is really well done in not hitting you over the head, showing, not telling.
Yes.
It shows, like, the relationships with Michael and his brothers is not explicit, but you understand it just from their interactions. Michael's kind of B or C plot with the moneylender, the loan shark that he owes money to, never is explicitly stated, but you understand it just through all the interactions that wind up happening. You know, they never go out of their way to be like, I loaned you this amount of money and you said you'd pay it back.
I love how the loan shark is like basically a kindly old man, except for the gold chain around his neck. And that's how you know he's actually kind of a scumbag.
The slightly flashy shirts.
Once in a while, he's like a little pushy of just like, you need the money earlier than that. It's just like,
find a treasure map.
Yeah, find it and start digging.
Bill Raymond is really good as Gabe, the money launderer. Like, he's so kind, like you said, kindly, but also menacing.
You never find out who he actually borrowed the money from.
No.
No,
because okay. Like, whoever that is referenced a couple of times. Like, the loan shark guy is like, he's like, if he finds out that you're playing cards with his money, there's no more discussion.
Yeah, the dialogue ends there.
Like,
or that they're really looking for the brother.
Yes,
like, you know, but
he's trying to protect his brother.
Yeah, I mean, it's not material to the story who the he is there, but it made me wonder, did he, like, borrow money from the mob or something? I don't know.
I mean, given that he is the kind of connections he has running throughout New York and other places, it's not hard to imagine him finding a slightly less murderous loan shark to try and get that money from, but also still, by nature of the profession, it's still threatening no matter what. Just a little, before we launch into the 4 days earlier and kind of where the story really kicks off, just a little bit of production history here. Most of this I'm gleaning from the commentary track. I actually watched this movie twice, once with and once without. And the commentary is Tony and John Gilroy. John is the editor of this film and also Tony's brother. And it's just them shooting the shit about, you know, kind of the nature of bringing the film to fruition and just kind of what they did. And it's very casual. It's a good conversation. But there isn't really like a really storied history here. Mostly it was just getting it off the ground. So it took about 2 years for Tony to write this script and kind of get it to where he wanted. And another 6 years, basically, to get the movie off the ground. He had talked to a number of financiers. Sidney Pollack and Steven Soderbergh came on as producers relatively early, but they hadn't really found, like, the main producer, the main person who's going to make the movie. And it took them that long to get there, but they did finally find a producer who was willing to front the bulk of the capital they needed. And so they got, once they got it off the ground, the next thing was getting George Clooney, because this was who he always had in mind for the role. And so at this stage, Clooney is definitely in movie star phase. Mm-hmm. Like, he's been in the Oceans movies, or at least one or two of those. He's been in a couple of Coen's films. During the filming of this, he won the Oscar for Syriana for supporting actor, which is another great movie if you've never seen it. And so, you know, like, he was definitely in demand and he was a little hard to get a hold of. But having Soderbergh, I think, on the roster was helpful because Soderbergh had made some movies with Clooney at this point. So when they finally managed to get in the same room, him and, like, Tony Gilroy just went to Clooney's house and essentially ended up hanging out there for, like, 9 hours, just shooting the shit about movies they liked and filmmakers they loved. And then Clooney said, yeah, I'll do it. And so then he started calling everyone, being like, Clooney said yes, Hillary said yes. And everyone's like, whoa, 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 slow down, slow down. So you had your phone off for 9 hours, man. We don't know where you were. What's going on? So, but Clooney was into it. And then this movie did end up earning 7 different Oscar nominations for Best Picture, Director, Actor, Supporting Actor, Screenplay, and Score. Didn't win any of those, but it did win Tilda Swinton a Best Supporting Actress Award for her role as Karen. I'm going to say very much deserved. I'm going to say all those nominations are very much deserved. Even James Newton Howard's score is just fantastic in this. Just a couple of other little details here. A lot of the Westchester stuff was filmed about 10 minutes from where Tony and John grew up. The shot where the horses are, that is an area where I guess a bunch of local high schoolers would tend to congregate and get up to mischief. And Tony hadn't been there in a long time, so he was trying to get the scouting location, like the location scouting people, to go find this spot, and no one could find it. So they spent a long time just trying to find this one area that Tony Gilroy knew, just so they could get this shot in this area, and they did eventually find it. And they only could film in that area about 5 minutes a day, because they were doing sunrise and sunset. And so they had to move the entire production there for about 3 or 4 days, just to get all the shots they needed for that. And if it had started snowing or anything had happened, they basically would have been wrecked, and they just lucked out. Also, a bunch of the, basically a bunch of the stuff that sort of decorates Clayton's son's room is just stuff taken from Tony Gilroy's son's room, like his action figures and a lot of the various doodads. And I guess his son was also very big into like video games and fantasy fiction, which is where a lot of that sort of like character detail kind of rose up out of. But that's kind of it. Like, otherwise, they just decided they wanted to make a legal thriller that would never really set foot in a courtroom, and I think they mostly achieved that here.
Yeah, I had to look up after if it was based on any kind of true story, because it... I mean, listen, this... There's probably... There's nothing funny about, like, big company basically trying to sweep... incidental death under a rug, right?
Like incredible malfeasance.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. And like poisoning water supplies, right? And so...
And knowing about it.
And knowing about it. And like, unfortunately, seems like something that could be based on a true story with just some people swapped in and out. But apparently it's not. Apparently it is, you know, as much as these things are fiction, is fiction. But
I mean, you can definitely see some parallels between, like, the same PG&E case that happened with, like, Aaron Brockovich and all that stuff. But, like, this is the kind of case that you inevitably see with a lot of these sorts of corporations.
God, was Aaron Brockovich about PG&E?
It was, yes.
Wow. Wow. Moving on.
Great corporation, that PG&E. So, yes, we flash back to 4 days earlier where Arthur has had his episode. And Michael Clayton is called to Milwaukee to try and unfuck this situation as best he can, and he is joined by Karen and a number of a couple of legal aides from New North, as well as the on the ground lawyers who are all about 25, 26 years old and just look absolutely fried.
Yeah.
Who were, you know, there at the moment, and you don't actually see that much of what happens, because apparently he ran stark naked through the parking lot afterward. There's no footage of that, but there is of him stripping down in this deposition, and the face that Tilda Swinton makes as she is watching this video is genuinely one of the most authentic pieces of horror I've ever seen in an actor's face.
There's some good character building early on where they kind of make it pretty clear, not directly, but through implication, that she has essentially sold her entire life to this corporation.
Yes.
There's she's not fully confident in the role yet. There's a lot of her rehearsing. She's giving like an interview on taking the role. Is that what it is?
It looks like it's kind of a puff piece about UNorth in general.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, at that point, she says she's been doing it for 12 years or something. Okay. But
she took over for the guy who is now the CEO.
Right.
Like, yes. But the real key takeaway, which is super important later, is that she is 100% a company woman, like absolutely an apologist for all of the wrongdoing that has taken place, just a fixer on the corporate side.
Yeah. There's a line in the commentary where Gilroy talks about Swinton's approach to the character, and I guess her notion was that Karen is a bad actor who is failing at the performance of her life. And so she's just doing everything she can to put on the bravest face and just be like, you know, the the good corporate soldier for this company because she doesn't know how to do anything else. And it's, you know, I think that as you start to see her start to come unraveled over time, that really starts to present herself where she's like, she is clearly trying to fill shoes and fix a situation that is way too big for her.
Yeah, she seems underconfident.
Yeah.
She's like, you know, there's a hesitancy to, I feel like, most of her actions. And a kind of, is this what people do? Is this the way we go about doing these things? You see it in her interactions with, like, three or four people where the person she's engaging with kind of has to lead her into the decision.
Right? Yes.
Like, I think this is what we're supposed to do. There's a great scene, we'll probably get to it, with Mr. Vern, Mr. Vern, where there's like, is that a yes, we're moving ahead, or a yes, do you understand? That's a very good
and
example.
You can see the wheels turning of like, oh God, I have to make a decision here. Holy shit.
Right. Yeah. It's like, yeah. You know, her whole thing.
Yeah, she's very good in this role. I mean, we'll get into it later, but I very quickly cease to find her to be remotely sympathetic.
Oh yeah,
as soon as it becomes clear the monstrousness of both the institutional acts that she's covering for, and then the specific acts that she commits herself later.
Like, there's nothing sympathetic about it, but I do think it is interesting the way they choose to portray her as alternately falsely confident and deeply pathetic. Like, it is. You know, you get more and more of that as she continues to make worse and worse decisions. But just the way it sort of unravels over time, I think, is genuinely like one of the two or three best things about this movie.
I feel like, you know, I don't want to really compare this to any extent that her character than the atrocity she did. But I feel like we have met people in the corporate world that you could, or at least I have in my life, that I could map that kind of behavior onto, where you're in that corporate bubble and things just seem to be moving along in a way that's, until somebody pops the bubble and exposes it to the air from the outside, and you're like, what are you doing? And you're just like, oh, this is just how we did that. We just lay people off, or we just, you know, we just do all these things.
Or we just order assassinations.
Yep.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Nobody I know.
We fix problems.
No one I know has fixed that kind of problem, but I have seen weird stuff. I mean, we saw it, again, I'm not trying to equate the monstrosities, but over at, when we were at GameSpot before we left, there was like a weird corporate bubble there that seemed to be operating without exposure to the outside air. And you're like, what kind of decisions are you making inside rooms that, you know, if shown to daylight would have just disintegrated. And it feels like her character just gets wrapped up in this weird walled off C-suite where maybe those decisions are fine until that bubble is popped, you know, and exposed again to the outside.
Well, her entire existence is just making sure the conveyor belt keeps running and that Dawn is never bothered. You know, like, that is really what it comes down to. And that is, you know, again, that's a deeply pathetic place to be working from, but it's just kind of what that character is. Before we really get into stuff with her, we really kind of get into it with Tom Wilkinson's Arthur here, as Clooney arrives at the police station in Milwaukee. And so you get a little bit of this, what is described here as a 4-page monologue in the very beginning, in the opening kind of scenes, just sort of talking over Michael Clayton going through his beats. But then you get the rest of the conversation here. And the thing I will say about Tom Wilkinson's performance as Arthur is manic depression is one of those things that, when portrayed on film, can be done in a very respectful and restrained way, and also can just become scenery-chewing garbage, and he completely pulls back from the latter. Like, there is definitely a degree of mania, there is definitely a degree of, you know, rushed and disordered thinking happening here, but he is not chewing the scenery, he is not just going off the wall, like bouncing off the walls here. He is having a genuine moment of clarity that is unfortunately, you know, couched in this very frantic delivery that cannot be read as anything other than his mental illness coming completely to the surface.
Right. Like, it helps tremendously that at the core of this break is this moral epiphany that he has had.
And the epiphany is that, you know, this case he's been working on is a horrific sin that he just can no longer sanction now that he's off his meds. He sees the actual moral clarity of what is going on here and describes, you know, what he felt as like living with this patina of shit all over him. and, you know, had his moment of clarity while he was having two Lithuanian women suck him off in a fucking in a cat house somewhere in New York. And they're just, the line deliveries here by Tom Wilkinson are really something.
6 years, Michael. 6 years I've absorbed this poison. 400 depositions, 100 motions, 5 changes of venue, 85,000 documents in discovery. 6 years of scheming and stalling and screaming. And what have I got? I spent 12% of my life defending the reputation of a deadly weed killer.
We had an agreement, Arthur.
One night, right? I look up and there's Marty in my office. He's got some champagne. And he tells me we just hit 30,000 billable hours on you North and he wants to celebrate. So an hour later, I find myself in a whorehouse in Chelsea with two Lithuanian redheads taking turns sucking my dick. And I'm laying there and I'm trying not to come. And I want to make it last. So I start doing the math. I think 30,000 hours, what is that? That's 24 times 30. That's 720 hours in a month. 8,760 hours in a year.
Arthur.
No, wait. Because it's years. It's lives. And the numbers are making me dizzy. And, you know, now instead of trying not to come, I'm trying not to think. And I can't stop. I mean, is this me? Am I this freak organism that's been sent here to sleep and eat? And defend this one horrific chain of carcinogenic molecules? Is that my destiny? Is that my fate?
You promised.
Is that it, Michael? Is that my grail? 2 Lithuanian miles on my cock? Is that the correct answer to the multiple choice of me?
You want to go off your medication, that's fine. But you call me first. That was our agreement.
Sue me.
Yeah.
Did he know at this point, and we'll get into this because it's a major plot point, did he have that memorandum in front of him, like, for the entirety of this case, or had he just obtained it?
I was just gonna ask you guys that. When did that come in?
It's not. So I mean, I'll just say it. Like, there's more of an emphasis soon, but there is a memo from the corporation that proves extremely explicitly they knew exactly how bad this chemical was, and they chose to cover that up and rush it to market anyway.
Like, the words so like cost-benefit analysis are in there and all that stuff.
So like hundreds of deaths have directly been linked to this chemical, and it's implied that, like,
it's in the water supply.
Potentially endless numbers of cases of cancer could be linked to this.
And I think it's implied in that to make it traceable would cost the company too much money to kind of go back in and add odor or color to the chemical. Would not be in the company's benefit, bottom line. And it's signed off by the Don.
It's the full like Fight Club, like, yeah. Will a recall of this automobile cost more than the settlement cases for the people who die in it?
Right.
Yes, then don't do it. That kind of shit.
Yeah, so he's got it in his possession, but I guess the question is when did he come?
So, yeah, so that, yeah, I don't know if that's what prompted his turn.
I assume that was the inciting event. The thing that they never are clear exactly when he takes possession of this document, though. They later on they show, you know, in pretty good detail just how much material Arthur had been sifting through of all these, you know, legal documents and memos and all these other things. The thing they say is that he wasn't supposed to be there for that deposition because there's no reason for Arthur to be there. That's just, they're literally filming a deposition. It's not court. But he flew out there last minute without telling anyone. So presumably he found this document sometime just before that and somewhere in there decided to go off his meds. And in that fevered decision-making decided, I'm going to go to Milwaukee and I'm going to plead my case to Anna, this girl who is sort of like, to him, his, you know, I guess, like, kind of the central figure for him in this case of, like, a person who is completely innocent and has ultimately been destroyed by this company's greed and malpractice.
Right, her family, members of her family have been
both her parents and her brother, yes.
Yeah. Right, so it becomes kind of the example of this entire class action suit.
Yeah.
The focal point of it. And the person he's really trying to save. And I think you're right. I think he does a pretty good job of seeming like somebody who is both distressed, but not rational.
Yeah.
Like acting irrationally, but with cause, but is not doing himself any favors.
Like stripping down naked in the deposition room was probably not the way to make the point, and even he concedes that.
Yeah, but even when he's saying he's like he's tearing away the he wants to give his clothes as penance for
he's trying to become clean again.
Yeah, there's a thought behind it, but it is not a rational rational thought.
And they spend one fairly fraught night in Milwaukee. You're starting
in the
to see
of a blizzard
in the middle of a blizzard. And you start to see a little bit about how far both the firm and Clayton's tendrils reach, because he has a cop that he can just pay off to watch Arthur while he goes and has a meeting with Karen, where she dresses him down. She's pretty fucking pissed off because this law firm basically just came within a hair's breadth of blowing up their entire case. And, his job is both to, one, manage Arthur quite literally, and two, try and smooth things over with Karen and you, North, and let's say neither is particularly receptive to the idea.
Karen? Hi, Michael Clayton.
You're late.
I know. Well, I'm sorry, it was a little more complicated than we thought.
Where is he? We've been here since 5:30.
He's asleep.
We'll wake him up.
Well, that's not gonna happen. We just got him sedated. Once he gets back on his regular medication, then it's just a matter of time.
Have you seen the video? The tape?
I heard about it.
What happened after is worse. This is in the parking lot, okay? People running for their cars. He's there in his socks, nothing else. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I will not sit with this sickness any longer. I cannot aid this sickness any longer. What does this mean?
I'm not sure.
You've been with him the whole evening. What's he saying?
It wasn't really making much sense.
This is totally unacceptable. This is a $3 billion class action lawsuit. In the morning, I have to call my board. I have to tell them that the architect of our entire defense has been arrested for running naked in a snowstorm, chasing the plaintiffs through a parking lot.
I understand.
What sickness is he talking about?
I don't know. It could be anything.
Well, give me one.
Frostbite.
Do you think this is funny?
Look, his wife was sick and she died last year. His daughter doesn't talk to him. He's all alone. All he does is your case. He skipped his pills. He had a bad day. That's it.
And you're somehow the authority on this?
His last episode was 8 years ago. I was there. I helped bring him home. I watched him get better. That's it. Come on, Karen. You didn't hire this guy because of his low-key regularity. You hired him because he's a killer and because he's brilliant and because he's crazy enough to grind away on a case like this for 6 years without a break.
Excuse me. We pay for his time.
I thought you wanted an explanation.
In the morning, I'm calling Marty Bach. But then you know that. Thank you, Michael.
Oh, can I jump in? There's one thing I just remembered that a piece that I'm not sure fell into place for me. In the very beginning of the movie, there's the scene at Kinner, Bach, and Leiden?
Yeah.
Where the reporter is trying to get a quote for that story. Mm-hmm. Is that ever... That's later on when they're going to settle. That's way later on. But does that reporter ever come back into the mix, or is that just...
I think it's literally just there to illustrate like the time crunch everyone is on and the immediacy with which this the settlement is coming together
and the public nature of it. Okay,
because up to this point they've always maintained that they were not going to settle, and so it's a story because if they're rushing to a settlement, something must have happened.
Okay, I didn't know if that I missed something later on where that comes more into play.
Yeah, so. You know, they spend the night in Milwaukee. At somewhere in there, Arthur gets on the phone with Michael Clayton's son, who had called his dad, but I guess his dad had left his phone in the room. So his son is very into this fantasy series called Realm and Conquest, which is, I think, about what, based on his description, it sounds like a bunch of vagabonds and, you know, roustabouts and otherwise unseemly characters all kind of congregating in this one place where no one knows each other's names, no one really knows what anyone did, because who knows, they might be enemies without realizing it. It's kind of borderless, you know, like a lawless hinterland.
A little Casablanca-ish.
Which definitely feels, you know, like something Michael Clayton can relate to. I think he says as much. But he's describing this book to Arthur on the phone in the middle of the night, and Arthur is just rapt with attention about this and really wants to know more about it. Because I think he also feels like maybe... of a kind with some of the things that are being described.
Yeah, he's definitely, you get the sense that he is way into it, not just pandering to this kid.
Yeah.
He's like, I need the name of the book. give me the name of the book. And also there's a scene where, you know, the son is trying to tell Michael Clayton about it. And Michael Clayton is just kind of like, yeah, okay.
He's the very busy divorced father. Yeah, you know, he doesn't have time for this.
Right. Your books. Yeah, that's fun.
Yeah. Eventually Arthur escapes. He's shuffles off into that good night, without, or actually I guess into that good morning, the next
day. Out the bathroom window.
Yep. And so Arthur is kind of on the lam and, eventually finds his way back to New York City, as does Michael Clayton. And the rest of the movie pretty much just takes place in New York. And so everyone's kind of on the hunt for Arthur. And in the middle of all of this, Karen has gotten a hold of Arthur's briefcase and knows that he has this memo. Mm-hmm. And that is when she decides to call Mr. Verne to see what can be done.
So, yeah, okay. This is a weird scene. This is part of the, I think everybody's better at subtext than I am here. Mm-hmm. She's holding the memo with a plastic bag on her hands. Like, she doesn't want to get her fingerprints on the physical paper at that point, which is a pretty great scene. And then is on a call saying, does she say where she got the number? Say Don? Okay. Yeah. And then the guy on the other end of the phone is like, do you have a computer? Do you have email?
We got a little encryption dealio. It works real great. It's very self-explanatory.
So at this point watching the movie, I wasn't sure if she was leaking the memo to a reporter or what was happening. But it wasn't until I think after, like, the scene after is them bugging Arthur's apartment or basically wiretapping some conversations.
Yeah, it's... these guys, Verne and this other dude, played by Terry Serpico, I forget what the character's name is. These guys are also fixers, but of a very different kind. They are contract for you, North, and they are kind of your all-purpose, do you need espionage?
A little wet
and also maybe a little murder?
Do you need a car bomb planted on somebody by chance?
Yeah.
Do you need somebody to die and look like a suicide?
So their initial job is just to track Arthur. Like, that, they want to see what's going on with him. They want to kind of get a sense of, like, what the actual, you know, what is the spillage here? And so they start going through his apartment. Michael Clayton is also furiously trying to track down Arthur, though the guy, Verne and his partner have already kind of found Arthur at this point. He's, like, wandering through Times Square at one point, and they're just following him.
And have his apartment tapped.
Yeah.
Like, he's, and because Arthur is calling Anna, the... one of the plaintiffs in this.
The woman from the deposition.
The deposition. So that's a big problem, too.
Yes. It's not only that he has this memo, but he is literally talking to the plaintiffs in a way that makes it think like he is about to literally flip sides here.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in amid all of this, there's other stuff going on at the firm. There is some kind of merger potentially happening with a London firm.
It's implied that the firm, despite being supposedly one of the biggest firms in the world, is in financial straits.
Yeah.
And kind of has no choice but to merge with this London firm.
And I really do appreciate Sidney Pollack in this role as Marty in the few scenes that he has, because there is this incredible amount of gravity to everything he says, despite the fact that everything he says sounds incredibly casual.
He's very deadpan. I was going to ask, like, is he primarily an actor or is he more behind the camera? I thought it was.
So he's both.
Ladder.
He's done a fair amount of supporting acting. Like, he's had some big roles over the years, but also he was a director.
Right. That's the main. I mostly knew him as that. I didn't realize that. In fact, I didn't even know who he was until I saw the name.
Yeah.
But yeah, very deadpan.
Very good in this. Like, like you said, there's almost like mafia boss esque where. He's got his cool most of the time, and everybody just kind of takes his word.
Yeah.
And he's taken over the case, right? Like, he has all the documents moved to his house and realizes that Arthur may have been kind of subverting this case for longer than they thought.
Yeah.
Technically, he moves the case to bury the asshole.
But he has, but doesn't yes. he have but all he, the documents in his place?
Initially brings them there.
I've got actually weird coincidence that I've got in front of me. He literally just says Barry's taking over you, North.
Oh, right. Yes. Okay.
But obviously he's one of the named partners. Like, he's got his hands on everything here.
There's a key thing that Gilroy says about Marty, when talking about the character, is that he only lies once in the entire movie. And the only time he lies is when he says where he got Arthur's briefcase, because obviously we know that Karen had it. And he says that suddenly the briefcase, you know, when it appears at his home, and Michael's like, where did you get that? He's like, oh, I don't know. Came up with a bunch of his other stuff. which did not happen, obviously, because it had to have been handed off from UNorth. But otherwise, at no point does Marty ever actually lie or say anything that is not pretty firmly what he says at face value. As much as these lawyers will, you know, work for the scum of the earth, they're being pretty plain spoken with one another through a lot of this. In the middle of all of this, there's also Michael dealing with the fallout of his failed business venture, which is the restaurant that he had opened with his youngest brother, who was a drug and also gambling addict, I believe. And so that flamed out pretty quick. Early on, you see him like literally at the restaurant while they're auctioning off all the stuff they have. And intermittently, he is meeting with this loan shark and also just kind of trying to figure out a way to pay off this debt while also trying to negotiate something out of Marty and the law firm, which, you know, he only can kind of do in little hits and starts here because ultimately Arthur is taking over everything.
Yeah, so he's 80,000 in the hole. He kind of needs 80,000 in a
in well, 75 he's in the hole, and I think he just asked for 80. It's just as like a round number.
He has like a week.
Yeah,
he's got like a week to get it, which is, you know, interesting. It comes into play a little bit later in the movie because he's going to ask for the money up front from his boss, Marty. But also his role kind of gets clarified in that whole discussion, which is kind of important, where he, you know, he's got a background. He was a lawyer. He was, you know, maybe on a track to be, if not a partner, kind of higher up in the firm. But they found he had very useful skills being this fixer, and so he never got on a bigger track and a big payday. And it seems like he's doesn't really make that much money at this giant firm where you think he's just wearing these nice suits and driving nice cars and maybe not relative to the other people in the firm.
It's sort of unclear exactly what led to him falling into this space, though I have to imagine some of it ties to his previous gambling addiction.
Gambling, yeah.
But so he was
originally he was an ADA in Queens.
Yes.
And he was like on a pretty upward law enforcement track.
And then, you know, he starts at the firm sometime in the 90s and then basically just his record kind of disappears. He doesn't do trials, like he doesn't do any kind of litigation. He's just been this guy who is not even a partner, despite having worked there for like 12 years. And no one really seems to know what to make of that exactly, other than who is this guy?
Yeah. When he does ask for the money, I think Marty says, like, oh, God, you're not in the gambling again.
Or, yeah, you're not back at the card tables.
Yeah,
are you?
Well, he's like, put me back in the courtroom. I'm good at it. And he's like, oh, you're a good litigator. So are a lot of people. You know,
yeah,
but,
yeah.
Like, but like nobody,
you have
nobody is as good at what you do.
Listen, Marty, I'm in a bind here. I need a loan. I need 80 grand.
I thought you were done with all that.
Oh, it's nothing like that. It's not the cards. It's none of that. It's the restaurant.
80,000.
I'm sorry to jump you like this, but I've been trying to get a meeting loan with you for the last 2 weeks. And I know about the merger, whether I'm supposed to or not.
Oh, there's nothing final on the merger.
Well, that's why I'm asking you now. You're my meal ticket. I mean, once you're out, then it's me and Barry with a room full of strangers, and I'm trying to explain what the hell it is I do.
Everybody knows how valuable you are, Michael. Everybody needs to know.
I'm 45 years old, and I'm broke. I've been riding shotgun for 12 years, and I got no equity. I'm sorry, I don't feel reassured.
Nobody told you to go into the bar business.
I only opened it so that I have something else. I'd have a way out.
I'd had no idea you were so unhappy.
How many times did I ask you to put me back on a litigation team? Hey, how many times?
Anybody can go to court. You think that's so special?
I was good at it.
Wonderful. So are a lot of people. At this, what you do, you're great. For Christ's sakes, Michael, you got something everybody wants. You have a niche. You made a place. You made a niche for yourself. And if it's nostalgia, oh, boy, you should have seen me when I was a DA back in Queens. Let me give you a serious piece of advice. Leave it there. God forbid you're not as good as you remember, because I've seen that happen, too.
But I didn't come here for advice, did I?
So this is what? I give you the loan or you don't help out with Arthur?
I never said that.
No? Maybe you should have. I don't know how you're going to take care of this, but this is cancer. This is something we don't get it reined in and cleaned up soon. Everything's vulnerable. Everything.
What are you telling me?
That I'm counting on you. I'm telling you that by this time next week, Arthur will be under control, and everybody who needs to will have been reminded of your infinite value.
Jesus, Marty.
Hey, When did you get so fucking delicate?
But then, of course, that raises the question, why is he not compensated wildly then if he is the only guy who can be your fixer?
It's an interesting scene, too, because... go ahead.
To be fair, he is, because at one point he mentions toward the end of the movie that his lease is $8,900 a month, and that's like in 2007 dollars, you know, like the, probably 10 grand a month now or something. So, like, clearly he's been living pretty high on the hog, so it's not like he doesn't make money from them. I think it's just that he currently has none.
Well, he also said he threw pretty much all of his getaway money into the restaurant.
But, you know, like he may very well be paid a lot, but to get the money, well, A, he can't get it in a week regardless, but B, he would have to, like, make a whole lot of lifestyle sacrifices to do so.
And he's also concerned about this potential merger and what his, since he is not a trial attorney or he's kind of, you know, off the record with this firm, he's worried what his position will be once the merger happens. And if Marty, his boss, is no longer there or in charge, like, you know.
This is the part, like, there's one line here that I feel like is the thing that we can all kind of relate to, which is that, you know, suddenly this merger happens. It's me and Barry in a room, and I have to explain what it is I do here. I feel like every time Giant Bomb got bought, we had that moment of, like, we have to explain what it is we do here.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I kind of get where he's coming from on that.
Yeah.
So in the middle of all of this, eventually he does find Arthur kind of wandering the streets. He has a kid in the car while he's just hunting around his old haunts looking for him. He finds Arthur with a stack of sourdough walking the streets and
looks delicious.
It looks delicious. It's the best bread he's ever tasted. And I genuinely love this scene from Wilkinson because it's still that thing you saw at the beginning where he has this incredible moral clarity that is also a little bit clouded by, you know, his current condition. But the second Clooney starts talking about involuntary commitment, the lawyer brain just turns on a dime.
It's great. It's great because it's set up with a previous scene where they're talking about it with Marty. Clooney and Marty are talking about it. And Marty's like, we've got hundreds of lawyers on staff. Somebody should know about how to deal with somebody who needs to be committed. Who's the best person we have? And Clooney's like, it's Arthur is the best person we have. And you see that not too long later where he just has a great little monologue about how you should have got me back when we were in Minnesota. Like, that's where all the stuff happened.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I now have a criminal record there. I don't have one in New York. And the primary thing for commitment is a danger to oneself or others. Can you prove that?
Yeah.
They're putting everything on the table. You need to stop and think this through. I will help you think this through. I'll find somebody to help you think this through. Don't do this. You're making it easy for them.
Michael, I have great affection for you, and you lead a very rich and interesting life, but you're a bag man, not an attorney. If your intention was to have me committed, you should have kept me in Wisconsin, where the arrest report, the videotape, and eyewitness accounts of my inappropriate behavior would have had jurisdictional relevance. I have no criminal record in the state of New York, and the single determining criterion for involuntary incarceration is danger. Is the defendant a danger to himself or others? You think you got the horses for that? Well, good luck and God bless. But I tell you this, the last place you want to see me is in court.
I'm not the enemy.
Then who are you?
Goodbye.
It's so good. And it's, you know, obviously they've made contact. Now he knows where Arthur is. But he's also just completely bounced off his shield. Like, there's no... He didn't get anything out of that other than a location that he is still in the city and he is doing whatever. Right. But Arthur has some plans. Arthur has some ideas about what he's going to do. But before we get to that, we have to take a quick break. So we will be right back.
Yes! Here we are, all together.
Is everyone listening? Because this is the moment you've been waiting for, a very special piece of paper. So let's have a big, paranoid, malignant round of applause for United Northfield Cultivate Internal Research Memorandum number 229, June 19th, 1991.
All right, here we are. Everyone's here. And it's time to talk about Arthur's plan, which I'm not sure is really a plan so much as it is just him yelling all his cards onto the table via voicemail. Arthur decides first he's going to record.
Well, he knows that he's being tapped because he Clooney confronts him about talking to Anna.
Yes.
He's like, how could you possibly know that? Yeah, yeah.
So Marty told me. Well, how does he know that?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So he now is clued into his apartment being tapped.
Yeah. So he's going to go all the way with it. He's watching this commercial, which is apparently they hired a real ad firm to just shoot this 30-second ad for this fake corporation.
They could
do whatever they wanted with. And so he's recording the music from it to have as a backing track for when he yells the contents of this memo into the voicemail of both the law firm and Tilda Swinton's character and all this stuff. And it is just him laying the whole thing out.
It's basically spewing the details of this memo into the voicemail and essentially making it clear he's ready to go public.
Yeah.
I wasn't really quite sure to what end. Yeah. I don't know if you're supposed to know to what end.
This is the point where the movie like fully got going and it really just barrels straight through the second half to the conclusion.
Yeah.
Pretty single-mindedly, I found. Like, it's a lot of threads being set up in the first half, and this is the point where the stakes go through the roof.
Because it's the third episode of Andor.
A, he throws down the gauntlet, Arthur does, and then B, they deal with him quickly.
Yes. So, in the middle, so you're right, I don't know what the plan is here exactly, other than to say, he's basically telling everyone that he has a face turn here and he is going to release all this stuff. But in the middle of all of that, which we don't discover until later, he's also been planning to bring Anna out to New York to the point where he literally had champagne on ice in the fridge ready to go for when she got there. And I don't think his interest in her is at all sexual or like romantic necessarily. He has a very idealized vision of her as this perfect, innocent person. But I think to him, he doesn't want to sully it that way. It's more that like, I'm going to hold you up to the light of goodness here. And I'm going to show you that we can win against this kind of, you know, sort of like omnipresent evil that you are fighting against. I don't think he's actually trying to put the moves on her in any particular way.
Yeah, I mean, if you read his intentions against everything he said so far, it's probably more about clearing his conscience. I mean, it's hard to say for sure, because he does seem like a little bit of a sleazebag.
Yes.
In general, but in this case, I think it's probably on the up and up.
Yeah, I mean, he's intensely self-aware now of how sleazy his life has been up to this point.
Yeah, but go literally straight from that scene to, Crowder was her first name.
Karen.
Tilda Swinton. Karen Crowder. Like, Crowder on a street corner with one of the hitmen letting her listen to the recording of him essentially making this threat into his own voicemail, and she very tentatively orders a hit on him.
You have to contain this.
Contain?
Right. Well, that's my question. What's the option that we're looking at along those lines?
You're talking about the paper, the data?
Well, I'm wondering if there is some other option. I mean, something I'm not thinking of.
We deal in absolutes.
Okay. I understand that. I do.
I mean, the material, the papers. I'm not a lawyer. We try, we do what we can.
Well, the other way?
Is the other way. But maybe you want to bring Don in on this.
No, this has nothing to do with Don. He's busy. This has nothing to do with Don. Do you think it's doable?
Yeah, we have some good ideas. You say move, we move. the ideas don't look so good, we back off, reassess.
Okay.
Is that okay? You understand, or okay, proceed?
Yeah, that's maybe one of my favorite scenes, because even Mr. Vern seems a little like, we make things go away, and she's like, okay.
What are my options?
And he seems like kind of reluctant, or like, you know, they're talking around stuff in ways that were, you know, as entertaining as this movie could be, you know, it's not funny, but this part is just like, obviously they're not saying anything explicitly, so they might as well be talking about, you know, we reassess the situation and then we see what steps we need to take.
We have some good options in front of us.
Yeah, like I find these two dudes both incredibly amoral. Like, they are just mechanical operators.
Oh yeah, they are
very, like, very efficiently carrying out this extremely sordid business.
But like, he needs her to say no, like, go, right, and then, like, right.
Yeah. But the only emotion is a trepidation around whether Karen is the one that should be authorizing this.
Yes.
Like, you know, at one point they're like, "Are you sure you don't want to bring Don in on this?" You're like, "No, Don doesn't." Don, and I kind of understand where she's coming from. She wants to keep him clean. That is the entirety of her job, is to make sure Don Jeffries comes out, whatever shit is going on, he comes out squeaky clean. But also, she is making the worst decisions possible here.
It's not great.
No.
And they kind of, this may be one of the scariest scenes in the movie, with like brutal efficiency just out Arthur. It's really
just
rough.
That's what I mean. They literally just surprise him at the door, and like, there is no hesitancy. It's like a clearly well-rehearsed, or it's something they've clearly done a bunch. Like, they somehow sedate him as he's coming out of his door and immediately take him into his bathroom and inject him with something to kill him. And
well, so it's a couple
flood
things.
The bathroom and spill pills everywhere to make it look like he killed himself.
Yeah, so it's a couple of things. They stun gun him initially.
Oh, was that a stun gun?
Yeah, I think
the first
so.
Thing they do
yeah.
is stun gun,
okay,
and then as soon as he falls down, they shove something in his mouth that basically causes him to go unconscious.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, kind of just spray something in his mouth
or
something.
Yeah. I missed the stun gun, but yeah.
But the other thing is, they inject him with his own medication. Like, they've been in his apartment, they've seen all his meds, they know what he takes. So what they end up injecting him with is the stuff that he would normally be taking anyway, so that it does in fact look like a suicide.
And apparently spread some pills around.
Yeah,
flooded the bathroom. It is all brutally efficient.
It's really creepy, and it's filmed very like
very clinically.
There's no struggle. Yeah, it's done. Really, it's like he never had a chance.
I don't think there are any cuts in the whole sequence. In fact, I'm looking at it. There are not. It's really. They inject him like under his toenail.
Yeah.
So that they won't find the injection site.
They really
do that between the toes, but yeah, it's somewhere in there.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's really like, the whole thing is done in what? I don't know, Brad, you have it there.
It's like,
there's
it's
no cuts.
Like 3 minutes or something.
Yeah. And like this person's whole Arthur plan is he's dead and it is gone in 3 minutes.
Yeah. And it's
he is dead in 90 seconds. Like, this is it's fucked up. It's really fucked up.
And the creepiest thing about the scene is that like a good chunk of that length is literally just the one guy holding his fingers on the guy's neck for pulse. Mm. Like, and it goes at least 3 beats longer than you think it will. And it's very illustrative of like how sure they need to be before they leave. You know, they have to be absolutely sure.
Like, it's a really twisted inversion of medical care, because they operate with the efficiency of like emergency room doctors that have done this stuff 1,000 times, like counting for the pulse and finding the ejection, finding a vein and all that stuff. Like, it's.
Because they're not even really talking to each other, right? They just know what they're doing. They're not even communicating.
It's like a despicable mirror image of trying to save someone's life. It's really unpleasant, upsetting.
But, you know, initially at least, the suicide story plays. Like, most of the people at the law firm just believe it because, you know, at this point they think that Arthur is totally off the deep end. So they're just like, that crazy son of a bitch. Can't believe he did it.
Who is that? Who is the detective? He looks so familiar.
That's his brother.
His brother?
No. The one who gives him the Michael Clayton the news about the...
Yes, I know this
Arthur.
Actor.
An actor looks so familiar, but...
So he's one of those character actors that you see in like a million things, and he's an ex-cop is the thing, which is, I think, where he kind of got his, you know, he gets a lot of work playing cops.
Okay, yeah.
David Zayas.
Oh, he's in... he was in Dexter.
Okay.
The main
is he bald?
The main thing I know him not. I think it's still like pretty receding hairline. Okay.
All right.
I mean, but he's been in a million things.
Okay.
Yeah, he's in a bunch of other.
I don't mean to side tangent. I just reminded me of that actor and was like, where is that guy?
Yeah. David Zayas.
Yeah. Yeah, he kind of gives him the rundown on, you know, how they found him, what happened, and all that stuff.
He mostly plays cops and detectives from the looks of things.
Oh, definitely. Again, he is an ex-cop, so like that's
sure. Yes.
And I think George Clooney / Michael Clayton seems to buy it at first. You know, initially. He's got some questions, like why when he's talking to Marty in the bar, like, you know, they're both like, this is not a suicide kind of guy. This guy's like a pit bull who would take things all the way, you know, mixed metaphors here, but to the end
zone.
Why
would a guy who is not taking his medication at all suddenly take too much of it?
Yeah, right, exactly. Like, he's not sloppy. You know, Arthur's a lot of things, but this isn't like him. But, you know, like you said
initially
before,
it holds.
Like you said before, Marty doesn't really lie, and he kind of tells Michael Clayton, like, this is kind of a break for us. I hate to say it, but this is... Yeah. Kind of relieved.
Yeah.
And then, but you know, he's good at his job. He starts running down the truth very quickly, like almost immediately finds that Anna is actually in New York City when he calls her house and her sister berates him about what's wrong with you people to send this. This is not a complicated girl. Like, she's never been on an airplane. How could you send her to New York and not even come pick her up? And he's like, wait, she's here now. And so he goes and meets her at the airport inn.
Yeah, the LaGuardia Inn.
And essentially confirms the details of what Arthur had told her about coming out there. And then I found that the stuff after that with his other brother. Also, I think it's funny that there's like a bunch of Gilroys, like a bunch of Gilroy brothers that in filmmaking. There's a bunch of Clayton brothers in this.
In varying degrees of law enforcement, save for the younger brother.
In kind of a similar situation. But yeah, I really enjoyed the interplay between Michael and his like upstanding brother. Like,
I think he's the oldest, the cop brother, and I mean he's just you know, a New York detective,
right? And he Arthur's apartment is sealed because it's under investigation, and he basically uses his brother to kind of gain access to the apartment and try to paper it over,
yeah,
so he can get in there and figure out what's going on. And I think that's when he finds the champagne in the fridge and a mysterious receipt tucked into that fantasy book that Arthur had bought at his son's recommendation.
But while all this is going on, he's still being tracked by Vern and the other guy, and they see him go into Arthur's apartment, and they're just like, what do we have here?
Yeah.
And so I guess their solution is, well, let's just get him arrested, because the cops show up, they arrest Michael Clayton, they discover the seal on him. The detective he had previously been talked to is very stern and very unhappy with him.
I mean,
and his brother is even more unhappy with him because his brother is the one who gave him the new seal.
I mean, that seems like some pretty bad business. And he's got the brother. Is it Gene? Is that the name of the brother? He has to like pull. Timothy is the bad.
Tim is the younger brother who is the drug addict.
And I mean, he's this detective brother is on the hook now for giving him a seal to a crime scene. I mean, the ability to enter a crime scene.
Basically, it's like, hey, like I'm like, however long away from my 20 years.
Yeah.
And now you've put my fucking pension at risk.
It's a moment that you feel for this one brother who's like, man, you've got a lot of family drama to deal with between the two brothers, and that kind of sucks.
Yeah.
Gene Clayton, you're right, is the brother's name, played by Sean Cullen.
Poor Gene.
Yeah. But so, you know, once he gets out, he knows at this point that something is very much amiss.
Yeah. And then like it gets into just some straight up good fun detective work stuff, because he takes that receipt from the copy shop to go see what it was an order for. And they're like, we're trying to get a hold of you for what happened. You have your phone off. And like,
you only had 1,000 of these red covers. You want to pull it to other 1,000 blue ones.
Turns out they have printed something like 25 boxes of copies of this memorandum, ready for distribution.
Kinko's clerk, very much like sorry, sir. We had a
played by Tony Gilroy's son.
Oh,
nice.
Yeah.
Okay, then.
One of his sons, at least.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, we didn't have enough covers.
And then,
of course, Mr. Vern is right behind him in line and also manages to get a copy. And
he brings it to Karen, and she's like, we have to contain this.
hey, look, you know, once you've bumped off one of the people opposing your corporate malfeasance, what's another one?
Well, there's a okay. So I don't know if you both have seen Heat, but there's a bit early on in Heat where, you know, Al Pacino is, and they're going through the crime scene at the beginning after all those guards get murked, and they're like, oh, you know, shot the one guard, and then, you know, went and shot the other ones. Like, why did he do that? It's like, they already knew they were on the hook for one murder rap. Why not why not get rid of the witnesses and just say fuck it?
Like, it's very
professionalism,
like, right? Like the first murder was like a real tentative stop and go thing, and the second one is like, well, take care of this.
Yeah. And she's also so in deep at this point and so fried that she's not even thinking. She's just thinking containment above all other things.
You got to imagine also the escalation from, okay, I'm really nervous about having this one murder, but he does have a copy of this document, to, hey, there are 2,500 of these sitting in a Kinko's now, and this guy knows that there are 2,500 of these ready to go. So if you are sweating the one guy with the one copy that you thought, because I think at some point in the movie they also tried to confirm, where's the original? What did she say? There was a fire? Something happened at the...
We had a warehouse fire. We lost some documents.
We lost some documents, right. So I think she thought this was the only surviving one, or somebody made an illicit copy, to then learn there are 2,500 just sitting out there waiting to go out like freaking... flyers on it for a band is probably pretty shocking. What is this about the time that he's got it in his pocket? Is this when he goes back to Marty?
There's literally one last scene, and then we wrap back right back around to the stuff from the beginning of the movie. Like, it makes it, this is where it becomes obvious like how expertly done that framing device is, because the last scene is him taking the memo to Marty, like clearly basically ready to blow the lid off this whole thing. And he never has a chance to like get it out and put it in front of him because Marty is there waiting with his 80 grand.
Yep.
And like, there's
this a weird scene.
Like, he barely says anything because it's like, it's, you know, it's some pretty good inner turmoil on Clooney's part of morally the right thing to do here is to blow up this entire case, which is going to fuck me out of the money I need. But I really need this money.
So we cut you a check this morning. There's some strings attached. And Barry, there's no way around this. Barry's going to have to be involved.
What if Arthur was onto something?
What do you mean? Onto what?
You, North. What if he wasn't crazy? What if he was right?
Right about what? That we're on the wrong side?
Wrong side, wrong way, everything, all of it.
This is news. This case reeked from day one. 15 years in, I got to tell you how we pay the rent.
But what would they do? What would they do if he went public?
What would they do? Are you fucking soft? They're doing it. We don't straighten the settlement out in the next 24 hours. They're going to withhold $9 million in fees. Then they're going to pull out the video of Arthur doing his flash dance in Milwaukee. They're going to sue us for legal malpractice. Except there won't be anything for them to win, because by then the merger with London will be dead and we'll be selling off the goddamn furniture. That's 80. We're calling it a bonus. You got a 3-year contract at your current numbers. That's assuming this all works out.
You're doing this now? Look, I agreed to this, okay? But there's rules now. You want the contract, you're signing a confidentiality agreement. It's going to be bulletproof, and it's going to be retroactive. Because Marty's too nice to say it.
But with everything you know about this place and the clients here and the people who work here, it makes it a little weird when you come in and ask for 80 grand.
If I was going to shake anybody down, Barry, I'd come directly to you, and it wouldn't be for 80 grand. Is this him or is this you?
Hey, if I'm wrong, I apologize.
You're wrong. You're way the fuck wrong.
So there you go.
Enough, okay, everybody. He's an asshole, but he knows it. And you're on the record. Okay? Everybody happy?
Don Jeffries is here.
We're on the way. Call Bob Nast. Just see if they need help with this thing. You're welcome.
Well, and he starts to kind of go down that path, and then Marty just completely stonewalls him initially, not meanly, but just is very much like, yeah, they're evil. What did you think this case was when we took it on? Yeah. We know.
Yeah. Here's your 80 grand. You're welcome.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a sense, because what's the other dude's name who's in there? The
Barry.
Real dipshit. Yeah, Barry. There's a little bit of a sense of, you're not quite sure if Marty also thinks that Clayton is trying to extort them or blackmail
them. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, clearly Barry is saying that out loud, and Marty is kind of like, yeah, he's an asshole.
I do kind of love Barry's delivery of like, you coming in here and asking for 80 grand, knowing what you know about this firm, it's a little weird.
Yeah, I do like Clayton's response. I was like, yeah, you fucker, I would ask for way more than 80 grand if yeah, I were to shake down this firm, you son of a bitch. And then Marty's like, he's an asshole. Noted.
You're on record. Noted.
You're on record. Noted. Like, yeah, again, I think it speaks to the performance of the Marty character where clearly that guy has some problems with his scruples, but plays it pretty well. Like the character plays it pretty respectfully.
But, and so, but in his mind, the Arthur thing is a solved problem already. You know, like Arthur's gone. The memo doesn't fucking matter to him. All that matters is getting the settlement done, is getting this merger through, and making sure Michael is on his 3-year contract so he won't bother us again.
Yeah. Right, so that's the thing. They're going to put him on a 3-year non-disclosure contract by cashing the
retroactive
check. Retroactive, so that, you know, if he says anything, he would be... It's kind of a light setup for, you've got a choice now, Clayton. You've got this check, literally a check in one hand, and this moral choice in the other hand, right?
So, yes.
You know.
Yeah, so like this is where the brilliance of the movie like fully clicks into place, because this wraps right back around to the stuff from the beginning where he's off playing cards again, and then he goes out and gets the call about the hit and run asshole in Westchester.
Well, he pays off his debt, right? He
does
pays
pay off
the,
his debt.
The
oh, yes.
Charge.
Yeah, he gives the guy the money and says, see you around.
Yeah.
Please leave.
But like there's stuff at the beginning we didn't mention, like, they're like, it feels a little disjointed at the beginning of the movie. There's like kind of stuff happening and you don't know what the relevance is. Like before you even know who Tilda Swinton is, there are shots of her like stove up,
sweating.
Like stove up in a public bathroom stall, like drenched in sweat and looking super nervous. There is a bit when he's driving to Westchester where his in-dash mapping system starts like fritzing out, and he like kind of bangs on it to try to make the screen come back on. And then, you realize while he was in there playing cards, and it's finally depicted that that's when they were in his car planting the bomb.
Yeah.
But he came out of the game earlier than they expected, and they had to like abort. Where so, they got the bomb in, but he didn't fully finish wiring everything up before he had to bail. So
maybe this is the one place where I have a little bit of a problem with the narrative of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably justifiable in some way. You could say the Verns didn't have a lot of options, didn't have a lot of time to resolve this, but they go from this surgical strike on Arthur.
I have an answer for this, by the way, but go ahead.
Okay. So what I'm setting up is they go for this, I think, Brad, you described it really well, this kind of trained precision execution of Arthur. No messy bits. It's super clean. Agent 47 couldn't have done it better. Mm-hmm. To a car bomb.
Okay.
For
so,
Clayton. Yeah.
Here's the thing. Test audiences had similar questions, apparently.
Okay.
There's two things here. One, in the beginning scene, when they show him at the card table, they don't illustrate at all how long he's there. And so throughout the movie, you're kind of wondering, is he actually back at the card table? Like, is he gambling more regularly? Is he just kind of telling people he's not, but he is?
Mm-hmm.
And what you find out here is that this is the first time he's gone back in ages, and he only lasts 9 hands because he knows this is just not like he feels like shit. He's not happy here. It's not helping him at all. So he just leaves.
Yeah. I also think there is probably some plausible deniability in using a car bomb to kill a guy who's got a bunch of gambling debts potentially to the mob. Like,
that's the thing.
Like I think there was probably some thought that they could pass this off as like a
mob hit.
as his debt catching up to him.
So,
like, you know, and they would be savvy enough to also like make sure enough information got out about his kind of underworld connections and stuff.
You figured it out. So there is a deleted scene that shows the two guys making the bomb, and they are discussing, it's got to look Russian. It's got to look like a Russian bomb because that's who he's in hock with for the card room and all that stuff. So, like, there's a lot of detail in there about, like, why they're making the bomb this way, why they're going with the car bombing. But apparently it was just too long and didn't fit with the pace of what they were trying to do, so they just cut it. So that's why it feels, like, totally different, is because they are going for a very different approach and a different backstory.
The people in this movie pick up on subtlety more than I do watching the movie. Okay, I'll buy it. Yeah. So they're rushed. I think, Brad, like you said, they're rushed putting it in, and it's kind of half done.
Yeah.
It's a tracker and a bomb.
Yeah. And then we kind of get a recap of the hit and run stuff from the beginning of the movie, and kind of zoom toward the car bomb exploding. Except now we get some nice cat and mouse stuff of the Verns following him around, like trying to figure out when is a good time to activate the bomb, and like the signal's not super great because they didn't fully get it installed right and stuff. And when he pulls over to go look at the horses is when they basically get, I from what I could tell, it seems like that's when they get enough signal to be confident in setting it off.
He goes off some down back road that they don't know, they didn't see when they were following him, and so they're kind of lose track of where he is on the road, but they know he's somewhat close. They keep getting intermittent signal, and at a certain point, they just have to press the button. They have to hope and pray that they hit it. And they do hit the car, but he's not in it.
Yeah, and then so...
he throws his jewelry inside
the car. Yeah, you don't
car,
yeah.
Like,
see his reaction at the beginning of the movie, but then here, he runs down to the car, and it is, like, it's a... What is it? His watch and his wallet and stuff?
His like anything that would, like, have his ID on it.
Yeah, like, I assumed that was intended to, like, make people think he died in there, although there would be no traces of a body, which seems like maybe a little... but...
Okay, so two things here, and just real quick, before I get to that part, did you guys pick up on the significance of the horses at all? Like the like where there is any kind of echo for that in the movie? Because I didn't for a long time, but I only noticed it on this rewatch.
Interesting.
So there's an image when he's thumbing through the Realm and Conquest book in Arthur's apartment. There is a drawing of three horses standing on a hill in the book. And apparently that was added with CG because they decided at the last minute they needed some kind of tie-in to that scene. So that is where they put it in there.
Interesting.
It's the only CG like in the movie at all, really. So it was just a kind of a wild little thing. I'd always thought it was just like a nice little, hey, you know, he wants to be free and he sees these horses. But there is actually like a little bit of an image callback there.
Okay.
The other thing is that Gilroy's mentality is that he doesn't need this story to stick for very long. He just needs it.
Yeah.
People to think he's dead for long enough for him to get where he needs to go so he can reset himself up.
Like hours.
Yeah, it's hours, like a matter of no more than a day.
Matter of hours, he calls in a favor from Tim, who better fucking show up, considering he just saved his ass with $75,000. I guess, basically, it's implied, gives him a lift back to New York, which right into the last scene.
Yes.
Which is...
such a great scene.
Which is that Crowder is briefing the... I don't think it's the board, it's like a shareholder representative group or something.
I think it's like the board and shareholders, yeah.
Essentially, like, hey, we have decided settlement is probably a good idea here, and we've managed to mathematically optimize the amount of the settlement to the lowest possible figure based on like the cap on the plaintiff's attorney's fees, and we found a way to write it off in taxes in such a way that it'll basically pay for itself. It's just like, again, it's just the most fucking disgusting, like, corporate profits over human life stuff again. And she basically briefs them on, like, you'll find a settlement packet under your chairs. I'm going to step out while you confer with Don. And, like, man, like, right up until this point, I was really not clear. Like, is this going to be the kind of movie where, like, justice prevails? Or is it going to be a, like, everything is futile and, like, the forces of shittiness always win, and oh shit, oh well. But then she walks out and turns around, and he's just standing there with the memo in his hands.
How'd it go in there? Pretty freaky, huh? You see Arthur? He's wandering around here somewhere. I'm kidding. Lighten up. You got one of these? It's a great memo. It's an oldie but a goodie. I got your heart racing, don't I?
I don't know what the hell it is you think you're doing.
What do you think I'm doing?
The suit's over. We have a deal. Whatever that is, it's meaningless at this point.
You think? I must have gotten it wrong. I thought you had a tentative proposal. I didn't realize you'd signed all those checks. It's a drag. I got 1,000 of these things. What the hell am I going to do with them?
I'm calling Marty.
Good. Good. Do it. That's a great place to start. Let's find out who told him that Arthur was calling Anna Kaiserson. Let's find out who tapped those phones.
This memorandum, even if it's authentic, which I doubt, I highly...
I know what you did to Arthur.
It's protected. It belongs to you, North.
I know you killed
him. It's a cut-and-dry case of attorney-client
privilege. See, now that's just not the way to go here, Karen. For such a smart person, you really are lost, aren't you?
This conversation is over.
I'm not the guy that you kill. I'm the guy that you buy. Are you so fucking blind you don't even see what I am? I'm the easiest part of your whole goddamn problem, and you're gonna kill me? Don't you know who I am? I'm a fixer. I'm a bag man. I do everything from shoplifting housewives to bent congressmen, and you're gonna kill me? What do you need, Karen? Lay it on me. You want a carry permit? You want a heads up on an insider trading subpoena? I sold out Arthur for 80 grand and a 3-year contract, and you're gonna kill me?
What do you want?
What do I want? I want more. I want out. And with this, I want everything.
Is there a number?
10 is a number.
10? 10 what? 10 million? Where do you think I'm gonna get $10 million?
You know what's great about this? Did you read it all the way to the end? You see who signed it? Let's go into that ballroom and ask Don Jeffries if he wants to pass the hat for a worthy cause.
This would have to be a longer conversation, mm-hmm. and would have to take place somewhere else.
Where? My car? All right. I'm gonna make it easy. Let's make it 5. 5, and I'll forget about Arthur.
5 is easier. Yeah, 5 is something we could talk about.
Good. And then the other 5 is to forget about the 468 people that you knocked off with your weed killer.
Let me finish up this meeting. I'll talk to
Don. Do I look like I'm negotiating?
Karen?
1 second.
Everything okay?
Yes.
$10 million. Bank of my choosing, offshore, immediately.
Yes.
Say it.
$10 million, your account, the moment this meeting is
Karen, started. Everyone's waiting.
I'm coming, Don.
You have a deal.
You're so fucked.
What?
You're fucked.
What do you mean?
Take a wild guess.
Is there a problem?
I don't understand.
Here, let me get a picture while I'm at it.
You don't want the money?
No, you keep the money. You're gonna need it.
Is this fellow bothering you?
I don't know. Am I bothering you?
Karen, I've got a whole board waiting in there. What the hell's going on? Who are you?
I'm Shiva, the god of death.
He's got Arthur's great walking around out
yeah,
here, too.
I love that. That's a great line, too.
That was a joke.
Did you see yeah, Arthur? Yeah. He's wandering around.
Yeah. Because she is like
shell-shocked.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about it a lot, but she is kind of, she feels like a loose grasp on everything from most of the movie, and she is just a pinky on the ledge at this point.
Well, and the best part is she's walking out all puff-chested, like, just thrilled with like how her presentation went.
Like, I made yeah. it. Where this is yeah. finally done. Everybody that was trying to sink this whole thing is dead.
I have like, saved
good.
This
I'm
company.
Good. I'm
the
good.
Settlement is in, like, end stages, let's say, of negotiation. And, yeah, he confronts her in a pretty good... I like the way
this is a banger of a monologue.
I've got nothing against George Clooney. I think he's fine. I don't think he's like the toppest of top tier actors. I'm not criticizing him. I think he's good, but not, you know,
he's not ultimate movie star for you.
He's not like Pacino level or whatever.
Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of the Clooney.
He's good, but yeah. like,
and he's very good in this.
I say that to set up that I think this is like probably the better, if maybe the best like Clooney acting moment I have seen.
Yeah.
Really the line that stuck with me is like you fucking try to kill me. I'm yes. the guy you buy. I'm yes. the guy. I'm not the guy you try to kill.
I'm a bag man.
Yes. I'm the fixer. You don't yeah. kill me. You buy me off.
Like, you fucking try to kill me.
Are you so yeah. blind?
Do you know who you're fucking?
And just her react. She's just like, she might as well be just be getting slapped over and over again. She is so out of her league at yeah. this point. What is he? He asked for, he's like, you buy me out $10 million. And
she's $10 million
like,
offshore account.
Where am I going to get $10 million?
Like, I
immediately.
You know.
And like.
Oh, he says a couple of jokes in there too, where he's like, was it in my car?
I sold out my best friend for 80 grand and a 3-year contract.
Yes.
Oh yeah. I forget exactly what the car thing was about.
Like I left it in my car or something like that. And like, just.
Oh, she's
just,
like, this would have to be a longer conversation. It would have to happen somewhere else. He's like, where my car?
Yeah.
Yeah. I sold out my friend for 80 grand. Yeah.
And a 3-year contract.
I did not see the little twist coming at the end of this, but he does go out of his way to really drop a lot of details explicitly about what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And make her say them.
Like, yes. Like, makes, like, straight up says, like, okay, 5 million for me, 5 million for the 468 people that you killed with your weed killer.
Yep.
Yeah.
And stuff. And then, Man, what a
And meanwhile,
amazing...
Dawn is like trying to call her in, yeah. So there's like two different forces pulling at her here.
Yeah, Dawn has stepped out and is like trying to get her to come in there and is starting to get pissed off, and then Clooney lifts the phone out of his jacket. Basically,
well, like, I think even before that, right, Dawn is like, security, and then like you see some people start rushing towards Clooney, and you're like, oh, is he gonna get taken out of here? And then they walk past Clooney, and then they go for Dawn.
What are you doing?
Yeah, what are you doing? What's going on here? What are you doing?
Yeah.
And then he takes the phone out of his pocket. It's a great sequence.
Well, so the first thing he does is, you know, like he gets her to say it. He says, like, yeah. 10 million, my account, all that stuff, as right. soon as this meeting is done. And he just smiles, says, you're fucked.
You're so fucked, yeah. You're
it's
so
such
fucked.
A good, just, yeah. like.
She's like, you have a deal. And he's just like, you're so fucked. And she's like, what?
Like, the way her face just melts at that line is just such good acting.
I didn't even notice, but I think one of the detectives is like, see if she's okay, or get her up off the ground.
See if she needs medical attention. Like Dawn has wandered over at this point, like, clearly the fucking... Like, the head of this multi-billion-dollar corporation is never used to being made to wait or told no or anything. And it's just like, we're waiting for you. Come on. What's going on? And then Michael...
Does she collapse? Is
she's clearly hyperventilating.
Clayton, oh yes, she falls to the floor. But then, like, Clayton just strides toward the camera as here come all of the detectives and cops straight up, like, taking Dawn into custody. It's
and
just
one
like...
thing, one thing Dawn is definitely not used to hearing is, I am Shiva, the god of death.
Which is a callback to one of Arthur's lines, but like it's just such a great moment of these fucking evil corporate assholes like just finally getting what's coming to them.
Which you hope. I mean, listen, you don't get to see the trial and the whole thing, but it is a pretty good comeuppance. And also Clayton's brother, Gene, is there to help
to get
out.
The bus, to get the collar. Yeah,
did you get all that? He's like, yep, you're perfect.
Stay close. So,
like. It's a very satisfying ending. I don't know how like believable it is.
Well, of course, when that thing goes to trial and they're like, well, how did Michael Clayton get this thing? Or that he broke into this apartment and
feels like things never end this justly in situations like this, but it's an incredibly satisfying ending.
I mean, the thing is, the impression I get is that he's out. Despite him having this contract, despite whatever, there's no way he ever goes back to that firm. There's no way he ever goes back to being a fixer. This was the last thing that he fixes, I think.
His walk-away money.
Yeah.
He doesn't look happy about it. He walks out and just gets in the cab and hands him $50, and he says, just give me $50, drive anywhere.
Yeah, and then credits.
And,
over.
And I love that sequence. I love that bit.
Like, it's just an extended shot of him looking kind of... Yeah, looking kind of just done.
And Gilroy asked him, like, what was going through your mind as you know, as I was shooting you and we were doing this. And he's like, I was literally playing the entire movie back in my head. I was just thinking about every single thing that happened in the movie up to this point and just, you know, just cycling through the events. And, like, it's just some really good subtle face acting and just, you know, a nice moment of watching this guy just, you know, untangle everything that he has been through over the last 5 days is about how long all of this takes.
Yeah.
You wonder because, you know, it's a work of fiction. None of this stuff continues after the movie, but like, what happens to the firm? Did the merger go through? Did this sink the firm? It doesn't matter. Like, did he sign a contract when he cashed that check for the 80,000 or is he done? Like,
I bet they cut him loose at this point. Probably the non-disclosure holds, but
yeah. Like, does he go to court? Like, does UNorth sink?
Here's what I know. Karen's up for murder, so there's probably no getting around that.
Do they get Mr. Veed or Vern? Mr. Vern, do they get does Mr. Vern go down?
She rolls over on them in a heartbeat.
100%.
Either they're in a non-extradition country tomorrow or they're in jail.
After that bomb went off, those guys flew out to somewhere else.
They're in Argentina right now.
They seemed at least competent enough to know they had messed up.
Yeah.
Like they, as you know, they went to that car to look for Clooney's body after and didn't find it and just left and didn't tell Karen and was like, oh, we're out of here. But yeah, it's a really entertaining, I was going to say fun ride, but there's nothing fun about it.
There's like three jokes in the entire movie and the rest of it is like very serious.
And kind of, you know, supremely depressing.
Yeah.
But it's entertaining.
But rousing. You know, by the time it gets to that final windup, Because again, there's only two scenes in this movie with Tilda Swinton and George Clooney, and both are complete reversals of each other. The first one is Tilda Swinton just dressing this dude down who has no idea what's going on and basically just being like, fuck you, you fucked us. You know, like really just kind of laying into him. And the second one is the total reversal of Clooney just destroying this woman and all the fucked up shit she did throughout, you know, this story. And I don't like, I think it is genuinely one of the most satisfying conclusions to any kind of dramatic film I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's not that kind of movie, but it's almost a jump up off the couch, pumping your fist kind of thing.
It's like, yeah, fuck Karen.
Yeah. I mean,
it was like, fuck this.
Yeah,
prioritization
you want
of greed and greed and profits over human life. You know, like,
I mean,
it's the most despicable thing.
You have that whole room full of shareholders of like, you know, dude sitting there nodding along, being like, this is the most optimized route through this, you know, horrible tragedy. Like, great, our profits will be okay.
Yes, because that's all that matters.
Yeah, it's...
Don't worry, these people are a tax write-off. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
So, I think the only hard part about... The hardest part about this movie is, like, I don't know. It's just so easy to map this onto... It's fiction, but it's so easy to map this onto reality with a different ending.
Yeah.
You know?
Where no one gets anything they want, and the people who are dead are still dead.
Or the companies get subsidies because, you know, they're job creators and they can't go under and, you know, like they're too big to fail style things in these megacorps and the whole thing.
There's like 70,000 employees around the world. No, around the globe.
Around the globe. Yeah. Around the world. Around the globally. Yes. When she's doing her practice for the speech.
I that's another thing we didn't really talk about, it, but I really do love those little scenes of her both rehearsing that speech at the beginning and at the end, like laying out her perfect business suit. Where she's like, I'm going into battle with my business armor type stuff. Like, yeah. It's just, I don't know, like, there's just, you don't know much about Karen, but you get everything from those scenes. What kind of person she is, like, what her insecurities are. Like, all that stuff comes through, and mostly, like, pretty wordless, or at the very least, no direct dialogue through those scenes.
Well, she has that one part when she's practicing, where she's trying to figure out the answer to the work-life balance.
Mm-hmm.
And
what
she
is kinda that?
She kind of can't figure it out, and then she settles on who needs that when you love what you do?
Yeah. Right?
It's a pretty clear moment where she is just all in. She is defined by this role in this company. Great movie. Thanks for recommending it.
Yeah.
Guys.
Brad, are you, obviously Andor was your primary, you know, window into all things Gilroy. Does this make you interested in checking out the rest of his filmography?
Yeah. I mean, there's, like I said, there's not that much, unfortunately, but absolutely.
I mean, he'd written some films, obviously, before this. He co-wrote The Devil's Advocate, the Al Pacino is Satan lawyer movie. He had, he was a script doctor, a doctor on Armageddon. He wrote, I think co-wrote Proof of Life, the Russell Crowe, Meg Ryan thriller that is mostly notable for Meg Ryan blowing up her marriage during that film. Okay. And he also wrote the first two, or I think actually all three of the Bourne films, the first three.
Yes.
Co-wrote, because a bunch of people wrote those movies.
Yeah, what is Duplicity? He did that after this?
I don't know that one super well, other than by some reputation, which is that I don't think it did very well.
Hmm.
He did that one. He also did the adaptation of Dolores Claiborne, the Stephen King story.
Hmm.
Who was it? I think Will was telling me when I mentioned that we were going to watch this. I should follow up on this and make sure this is actually true. There was some talk about doing a Michael Clayton TV series.
That's possible.
I should have actually Googled that to see if that was actually a real thing or not. Anyway, like that may be something to look up. The other thing I was going to say though is that Gilroy's been doing a lot of good interviews around Andor in the last few weeks. And there's been some really interesting stuff. Like, he did one for Script Magazine, scriptmag.com is the site, where he talks about, like, not how much easier it is to be a writer when you've directed, but, like, I'm trying to think how to put it. Like, he really talks about how much, like, having directed and knowing what it's going to take to get your words onto the screen goes hand in hand with writing effectively and writing in the most kind of, like, fulfilling the potential of your writing.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, he extends that in this, like he talks about, like they have the production designer of Andor in the writer's room the whole time because like You need to be talking to the guy who's designing and building the sets and like how everything's going to be arranged. Like, what can we have these characters do based on the world that they are visually inhabiting? Like, really fascinating, like, holistic approach to writing that he talks about that really makes it obvious, like, how he gets so much out of what he writes.
And it's wild that this is his first directorial effort. Like, he talks, you know, a decent amount about, like, the things he had to learn on the fly, like, the things that were more complicated than he thought they would be. But I feel like this movie has a very assured kind of directorial hand to it. Like, nothing feels shaky. You know, there isn't necessarily a lot of complicated shooting in it, but the shots they choose and, like, the way they choose to frame everything, I feel like is all very confident. And, like, the actors, I mean, I'm sure the actors, you know, being seasoned professionals that they are, probably didn't give him a lot, make him do a whole lot of, like, having to cajole into a performance. But, you know, it just, everything about this movie feels like someone who's been doing this for a long time.
Yeah, it's like this and Andor both, like, I feel are basically just kind of above reproach. Like, there's really just not a lot you can nitpick in there.
No.
At least from the standpoint of, like, filmmaking craft.
Except that one scene they cut about the bomb.
Yeah.
It just cleared everything up for me. You know, sometimes you got to cut for time, though.
It's true. Sometimes the pace of the scene dictates what can and can't be there.
Right.
All right, folks. Well, I think that is going to wrap things up for this week's episode and for Michael Clayton. I'm glad you guys enjoyed it so much. Again, it is, I think, an absolute stunner of a movie, and I'm glad you had a good time with it. Well, you had an enjoyable time with it.
I put it on later than I had hoped last night and was very tired and got close to the halfway point and was like, maybe I'll go to bed and watch the rest of this in the morning, and then hit that point where Arthur leaves that weird voicemail, and I was like, ah, fuck, okay.
I'm in.
I cannot go to bed now.
Give me these last 55 minutes. Let's go.
I think I'm putting this one under The Thing, Jaws, and Das Boot is going to be Michael Clayton. So between Das Boot and Above, They Live.
I'm going to put this one just above Das Boot, but okay. I think the other two are probably just slightly higher on my overall list.
Yeah, good movie.
Yeah. All right, well, we are going to be doing one more film this month, but that's not going to be for a couple of weeks. But we are, in fact, going to be making good on Brad's demands, and we are going to be watching Bram Stoker's Dracula the third week of December. Brad, are you very excited for this?
Everyone's favorite Christmas movie.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Dracula to Remembula.
Mm-hmm.
But so we are next week going to be doing our one Star Trek episode for this month. So you will be back to the Star Trek watching, and the episodes are going to be The Return of the Archons and Space Seed.
All right.
Now, Brad, do you know anything about either of these episodes?
I've heard the name Space Seed.
Okay.
But I don't know what it's about.
Archons, I will just say, is another Hollywood backlot episode, so get hyped for that. I remember correctly, it's a good one. It's a real goofy one. Space Seed, all I'm going to say is that a very important Star Trek character makes their first appearance. And that's it.
Okay. I think I know who that is.
You probably do.
I think
I'm not going to say it here for anyone who wants to be surprised.
Now that you've said that, I'm pretty sure I know who that probably is.
Okay. Well, we'll leave that for the audience to discover next week. As I said, those will be our two episodes, and then we will be doing Dracula, and then we will be taking the last week of this month off. As always, thank you, Brad. Thank you, Vinny.
Thank you.
And thank you at home for watching and listening along with us. We'll see you next time.